Human being done some unexpected things.
Are you going to bring more police, if not the army, here, just in case there is a security situation developing?
My government and my country, my Serbia, will not send army and police officer on this man. We will not lay finger on these children. And I call Hungarian police officer came in our border, see these kids and try to do something by force on them. We will not upon force of these people, no.
And have you had any discussions at all with your Hungarian counterparts today?
I try more than one. Unfortunately, only direct contact that we have is through the barbed wire, through the fence. It's not really a good way for communication. And I think that the Hungarian government and Hungarian minister, really, they always try to make up some excuse why these people cannot cross.
But the Hungarians say that they cannot cope with this large number of people. Is your government going to be able to cope with these people? None of them I've spoken to want to stay in Serbia, but what if they have no other choice?
Exactly. So Serbia is not a concentration camp. And please do not consider us as such one. So if these people want to stay in Serbia, we allow them. If they don't want to stay, allow them to not stay in Serbia. This is the Europe, or should be Europe. Unfortunately, Europe is now divided. From Hungarian fans is some Europe who really doesn't want respect any human being. I'm not sure that I really want to be part of that kind of Europe.
Alexander Vulin there, Serbian minister, speaking to Lise Doucette at the border with Hungary. This story will rumble on and on. We'll have a lot more coverage here on NewsHour, but from this edition of the programme, from me, James Kamaraswamy, and the team, that's all we have time for. Thanks for being with us. Until the next time, goodbye.
And good afternoon. The show is next on KJZZ, and join us at 3 for All Things Considered.
KJZZ will hold a job fair on Thursday, September 17th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Pima Community College downtown campus. This is open to anyone interested in a career in broadcasting. The job fair will be held in Building CC, Room 180, the Amethyst Room. Pima Community College is located at 1255 North Stone Avenue in Tucson.
In Valley traffic right now, eastbound on I-10, the right lane is blocked at Central Avenue. This is KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD, a service of Rio Salado College. We're on the web at kjzz.org.
KJZZ is supported by the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust, working with Unlimited Potential to expand GED and ESL classes to prepare adults for employment or higher education. Details at unlimitedpotentialaz.org.
It's mostly sunny right now in Phoenix and 93 degrees at 2 o'clock.
Another State Board of Education staffer the Arizona Public Schools superintendent tried to fire has resigned. But will those departures impact the ongoing dispute?
The board is not going to hire people who are going to say, gee, I don't believe in Common Core. So it may have replaced, you know, one problem with a different one.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, Arizona's Attorney General asked for more money for kids in state care. Why so many lawyers are involved in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's contempt proceedings. States are enacting more immigration-related laws this year than last. And want to test your product against the Valley's unforgiving summer heat? Send it to Buckeye.
It's getting a sunburn every day and not recovering.
Plus, bringing Wi-Fi online in schools and finding fruits and veggies near you. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. In California, some of those displaced by wildfires are being allowed to return to their homes and check on their property. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports 3 major blazes in the state have destroyed hundreds of homes and killed at least one person.
4 years of historic drought and a legacy of suppressing natural wildfires has led to conditions that are being described as extraordinary and unprecedented, both in the scope and scale of these fires. While not the biggest, the Valley Fire north of San Francisco continues to be the top priority due to its proximity to homes and infrastructure. It's destroyed the most structures and forced more than 10,000 people to evacuate with little notice. Meanwhile, firefighters have started to make some progress, digging containment lines around the blaze thanks to a break in the weather. another. Here in Central California, crews are also beginning to turn the corner on the state's biggest blaze, the Rough Fire. There have been brief periods of heavy rain and even some snow in the Sierra Nevada. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Fresno.
Police still aren't clear about what motivated a college instructor to kill his girlfriend and then drive nearly 300 miles to gun down a colleague at Delta State University. Police say the gunman, identified as Shannon Lamb, admitted to the killings in a handwritten note and a 911 call. He took his own life as police were closing in. Police say they believe Lamb killed his girlfriend, identified as Amy Prentice, at a home they shared in a small Mississippi coastal town. He then apparently drove to Delta State, where he shot and killed Professor Ethan Smith. Police say they don't believe there was any relationship between Smith and Prentice and are still trying to figure out what prompted the killings. The Food and Drug Administration is taking the unprecedented step of ordering a major tobacco company to stop selling well-known brands of cigarettes. NPR's Rob Stein has more on the FDA's action against R.J. Reynolds.
The four brands are Camel Bold Crush, Vantage Tech 13, and two types of Pall Mall Deep Set Recessed Filter Cigarettes, the regular and menthol varieties. The FDA says it took the action because R.J. Reynolds had failed to prove the brands aren't more dangerous than other cigarettes that have been on the market longer. The FDA recently got the authority to regulate cigarettes, and that includes the power to review any new brands to make sure they don't expose smokers to more risks than existing brands. In this case, the FDA says R.J. Reynolds failed to show the newer brands don't expose smokers to more harmful chemicals, more menthol, or new ingredients. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Negotiators for Fiat Chrysler and the United Auto Workers at last check were still bargaining, even as contract covering some 40,000 U.S. workers expired at midnight. Two sides announced this morning they've agreed to extend the now four-year-old contract on an hour-by-hour basis. Any deal reached between the union and Fiat Chrysler will likely serve as a template for subsequent agreements with General Motors and Ford. Solid 1+% gains on Wall Street as investors apparently were in a buying mood ahead of a scheduled two-day Federal Reserve Board meeting. The Dow was up 228 points today. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Aussie, a digital magazine dedicated to the new and the next, like a recent study that suggests a correlation between expensive weddings and shorter marriages. This and more at aussie.com/NPR. That's OZY.com. And from the sustaining members of KJZZ.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Quick check of Valley traffic. I-10 eastbound. There's an accident right at Central Avenue. As for the forecast, it'll be partly sunny, slight chance of storms this afternoon with a high of 96. Mostly clear tonight, still a slight chance of showers, overnight lows near 80. Right now, with some thick, puffy clouds overhead, it's 94 degrees at KJZZ. Storm damage is preventing the Phoenix VA healthcare system from accepting emergency room admissions for the second time in about 2 weeks. 39 patient rooms are currently out of service after another powerful weather system rolled through Phoenix last night. To deal with the loss of space, VA staff has rotated patients to different beds within the hospital and canceled some procedures that require overnight stays. That's according to VA spokeswoman Jean Schaefer.
We ended up with water coming in through the windows, and in some buildings on our campus, water came in through the roof.
On August 31st, monsoon forced the VA to transfer patients to other hospitals. Schaefer says the VA had just returned to full operations last Friday. Room-to-room damage assessments were ongoing this morning. At a briefing this afternoon, the Arizona Department of Public Safety says investigators continue to work around the clock to find the person or people responsible for the spate of freeway shootings on or near I-10 in Phoenix since late August. While there haven't been any incidents linked to the shooting since last Thursday, DPS spokesman Bart Graves urges the public to stay vigilant.
We really don't know why the shooting, thankfully, has stopped, but we are, I can just tell you this, we are continuing full bore with our investigation.
Graves says DPS has received about 1,000 calls on its tip line and that they haven't yet completed their investigation into the 18-year-old person of interest taken into custody late last week. The reward for information leading to the shooter has been raised to $50,000. A former union treasurer for Arizona Bus and Light Rail Operators has been sentenced to 18 months in federal prison for embezzling nearly $275,000. Federal prosecutors say 49-year-old Richard Wayne Johnson of Surprise was also sentenced to 3 years of supervised release. Johnson pleaded guilty in June to embezzlement, forgery, and false reporting. The State Board of Education will be meeting this hour. Among the topics of discussion will be replacing its executive director, Christine Thompson, who late last week announced her resignation. The board and Arizona's superintendent of public instruction, Diane Douglas, have been embroiled in legal and personnel battles. Joining me to talk about it is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, Superintendent Douglas tried to fire both Christine Thompson and her deputy, Sabrina Vasquez, earlier this year, and now both have resigned.
Yes, essentially, I think it comes down to, gee, I've had as much fun as I can handle. I mean, you've got a situation where Douglas's position is they are fired and they don't exist and I won't deal with them. And so, you know, it's got to be hard. It's got to take a real toll on you. And you say, you know, at some point you say, I want to do something else. Now, this creates a fascinating situation because the board, needless to say, wants to hire a new executive director and new assistant. But there is a provision in state law that talks about all this. It says that the powers and duties of the State Board of Education include employing staff, quote, on the recommendation of the superintendent of public instruction. Now, that's a fascinating question because does that mean they can only hire somebody that Diane Douglas has recommended? Do they have to consider her recommendation? Where does that fit in? And this should be a fascinating discussion this afternoon.
And that's basically, at least in part, what the lawsuit has been about, right?
Exactly. Now, the tricky part is when Judge Patricia Starr ruled, on one hand, she talked about the powers, but on the other hand, she sort of shunted the whole thing off till later, saying, look, this is a political question. This is an academic question. I don't have a live, real dispute in front of me, so I'm not going to rule on the question of Diane Douglas's power. And while I believe she doesn't have the power to do that, I'm not going to issue a ruling specifically to that effect. So it's still an unanswered question. Obviously, Steve Tully, who's Diane Douglas's attorney, is going to take the case to the Court of Appeals. He'd like the Court of Appeals to issue a ruling that what is in Title 15 about the duties of the State Board is, in fact, what the law means.
So do you get the sense that the State Board is going to try to fill those top two positions, irregardless of what Superintendent Douglas thinks about it?
I'd be willing to bet you lunch, dinner, and a trip to San Francisco on that one.
To where the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is.
Yes. It's very clear the board has taken the position that these are our staffers. And there is some language in Judge Patricia Starr's opinion that says these are the board staffers, and they seem to have the power to do with them what they want, including, for example, moving them out of the Department of Ed and over to separate offices in the Capitol Tower. So I think the board has taken the position. I'm guessing there'll be a 7-1 or an 8-1 vote sometime today, and I'll bet you can guess who the negative is, to go ahead and to proceed. Now, I don't know if they've got anyone specific in mind at this point, but they may, and we'll have to see that. If nothing else, they're going to start the procedure for screening people, and I'm sure that Diane Douglas will say, you can't do that until I submit a recommendation. And that gets to another question. What if she doesn't submit a recommendation? Does that mean they don't have an executive director?
Is there an element to this that would suggest that Diane Douglas, even though she failed in her effort to fire these two staffers, ultimately got what she wanted?
Well, if you remember when she tried to fire or did fire in her mind the two staffers, she called them two liberal staff who are thwarting my agenda. And that agenda, of course, is to get rid of Common Core. And it was very clear that the board staff was doing what the board wanted. The board supports Common Core. The board supports the AZ merits test. Now, did she get rid of two specific people, you know, at least indirectly? Sure. But the board is not going to hire people who are going to say, gee, I don't believe in Common Core. So it may have replaced, you know, one problem with a different one.
Is there any sense as to when we might get a final resolution to this, either that the board can hire its own staffers or that it can't?
I think this is going to have to go all the way to the state Supreme Court. I mean, we don't even have a formal appeal filed yet at the Court of Appeals. You figure they're going to want briefing on it. Perhaps they'll have oral arguments maybe before the end of the year, maybe early next year. Then whoever loses certainly goes to the state Supreme Court. They at least need to review the Court of Appeals decision to see if they like it if they want to have their own oral arguments. So I'm guessing sometime next year.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
Well, I'll let you know what happens after today's meeting.
And in an email statement, State School Superintendent Diane Douglas says she will not be attending today's Board of Education meeting. The statement goes on to criticize Board President Greg Miller, saying in part that Miller has turned board meetings into, quote, spectacles that do nothing but harm our education system. The number of children in state care has ballooned to more than 17,000. That's the highest figure in more than a decade. Arizona's top law enforcement official says his office needs more funding to look after them all. KJZZ's Phil Latzman joins me. And Phil, you spoke with the attorney general about this. Why is this so important to him?
Well, Mark, he says it's all about protecting those children. And Mark Brnovich is making an impassioned plea for more state funding to hire lawyers to clear a huge backlog of legal cases in the state's child welfare system.
Well, our office is asking for a $9 million increase in funding for fiscal year 2017 and an additional $1 million this year to pay for the overload of child welfare cases. As you may know, we have had a difficult time hiring and retaining lawyers because of the caseloads and because of the difficulty and the nature of the work dealing with these child welfare cases.
So each of the attorneys handling these cases has 146, an average of 146 cases each. How are they able to handle that caseload?
Yeah, each of the lawyers has about 150 cases, which is nearly three times what the American Bar Association recommends. Frankly, not is it only burning people out, but it almost borders on malpractice because of the nature of these cases and the number of cases.
Just that we're clear, the money that we're talking about, this $10 million that you need, would be used to hire attorneys for your office or to private contract them out?
No, our priority is to get the resources so we can hire more lawyers here at our office and retain the lawyers we have.
How much money does the average attorney handling these DCS cases make?
Well, the salary range can start in the 60s, in the low 60s. And what we have seen is that sometimes lawyers will come in here, they'll get a few years, they'll either get burned out or emotionally drained because of the type of cases, and they'll get better offers either at other government agencies or in the private sector. And that is why one of the tools we need is a tool to retain good lawyers, and that means being able to pay them effectively what they can get here in the market in Phoenix or in Tucson.
How is the overload in cases, and I see we have 17,000 now children in the state's welfare system, which is, I think, higher than it's been in a decade. How does that affect child welfare in the state?
Well, it's terrible because we aren't always able to provide the type of advice that we should and want to provide. We want to make sure that we don't have the turnovers in the lawyers, that we have lawyers that have experience. And ultimately, what you're seeing is a bottleneck in the system, which means that there's going to be greater delays in finding permanent homes for abused and neglected children. And so if you care, if you want to protect kids, you need to make sure the Attorney General's office has the resources it needs in order to not only represent the agency, but also make sure that we're doing everything we can to protect our kids. $10 million to protect our kids seems like a small investment to me. If we can't afford $10 million to protect the most vulnerable among us, then we have our priorities wrong in this state. To me, this isn't an issue of right or left. This is an issue of right or wrong. This is an issue of basic morality. What are we doing as a society to protect our kids?
Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, good luck in your request. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Legislators in 46 states passed 391 bills and resolutions related to immigration during the first half of the year. 153 of those were new laws. That's a 16% increase in the number of laws from the first half of last year. Ann Morris is the program director for the Immigration Policy Project at the National Conference of State Legislatures, which tracks this. And Ann, what do you make of the increase?
Well, in some senses, states seem to go through peaks and valleys in their attention to immigration issues. This year, we seem to have a spike, particularly in attention from California. They looked at a lot of movement that was happening federally and decided they needed to take action. So we saw a lot of attention to things like driver's licenses or professional licenses or health care. And sometimes it's a single state that seems to bump up the numbers, and other times it seems to be an issue. So it's a little hard to put a finger on, but this year the numbers are up.
And looking at the map, it looks as though most states have at least done something immigration related, some obviously more than others, but it looks like most have at least done something.
Yeah, we have found that where immigration used to be an issue for just a handful of states where there are significant populations, it's now an issue that seems to touch every state, whether it's involved in education and training for young students or higher education, or as states are grappling with driver's licenses, with the new population of deferred action for children of immigrants, the DACA children. Every state seems to be needing to look at immigration issues and adjust their laws.
What types of laws were states enacting as they relate to immigration this year?
Well, they are always across the board, but some of the newer trends are that several states seem to look to the federal exam for immigrants to become citizens of the United States and say, hey, maybe this is something we can use to help beef up our high school civics curricula. So that was an interesting new trend. And I don't know where it started, but seven states have acted.
I think it actually started here in Arizona.
Oh, that's interesting.
Have you seen a change in the types of immigration-related bills that states are passing now versus, you know, the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years?
Yeah, I think where we started back in, again, with Arizona in 2010, Arizona was one of the first states to look at immigration enforcement and feel that the federal government wasn't stepping up to its responsibilities. And there was a lot of state activity that year looking at similar things. How do they, how do states try to deter illegal immigrants from coming to their states? How do they improve deportation processes in partnership with the federal government? That was a big trend from 2010 to 2012 or so. And then, of course, we had Supreme Court decisions which said that states had overstepped the line and that part wasn't allowed. I see that the last portion of that was upheld recently in Arizona, where they can do questioning of immigration status during lawful stop. But that trend seems to have fallen away. I think the newer trend we are seeing now is looking at the reality of immigrant families in states and what some of the federal actions, executive actions, have done in terms of DACA and what these students who did not choose to come to this country, these young people who have been here for a long time, what do states need to do to make sure that they succeed? If the federal government is not intending to deport them, how do they manage to get to work? How do they manage to get to school? What needs to be changed to make sure that they are succeeding academically?
Do you imagine that states will continue enacting immigration-related legislation? I mean, do you imagine this dropping off anytime soon?
I don't, for a couple of reasons. I think states have gotten some expertise in managing immigration challenges within their states. The populations continue to keep changing. They may need to look at language translation for healthcare or for teaching kids in schools. And until the federal government acts, states are still having to grapple with these things on their own. And I think once we do finally, whenever, get immigration reform at the national level, they'll have to take some steps. And then maybe after that happens, then states can back away from the field and focus on other things.
Ann Morris is Program Director for the Immigration Policy Project at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Ann, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Still to come, the contempt of court case against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio keeps growing more complex, and with it, more and more attorneys.
The attorneys that are there don't even fit on the judge's side of the bar. They have to sit in the audience because there's not enough room. There's just so many people.
What all these legal bills mean for county taxpayers? That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. Checking Valley traffic at 220 I-10 eastbound, an accident at Central Avenue. At I-10 westbound, an accident has the shoulder blocked at the 202 Santan Freeway. Look for partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. 10% chance of showers and storms with a high of 96. Clear tonight, still a slight chance of showers. Overnight lows near 80. It's partly cloudy, 94 degrees at KJZZ at 221.
KJZZ is supported by Honor Health, still locally owned and not-for-profit. Scottsdale Healthcare and John C. Lincoln Health Network have merged and are making healthy personal. More information can be found at honorhealth.com.
It's the show on KJZZ for Tuesday, September 15th. I'm Mark Brody, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry.
All right, Mr. Hockenberry, thanks for coming in. What'll it be today?
Hey, Doc, I'm here for an MRI and some blood work. Just want to see how everything's running.
Good idea, no problem. I'll just hook you up. Just climb into the dark tube here.
Okay, there we go. Squeeze in. I noticed that you don't have a price posted on your sign there.
Price? Posted? What do you think this is, a gas station? Now just lie back.
Man, that's loud.
Yeah, we're getting great pictures. Just sit still while the nurse takes your blood.
Ouch, that's a lot of blood. A
lot of tests, Mr. H. There we go.
Okay, how much do I owe you?
Got me. How much do you got? Why don't I just take it all?
I can't do that. I'll give you a couple of hundred. Is that okay?
Well, that'll work today.
Today? What do you mean today? What's the price of an MRI and some blood tests?
Got me. On Tuesday, it's different than Wednesday. Today's Friday, and did you drive here?
Yes.
That adds 20 bucks more.
What?
But if your wife came with you today, we could knock off 50 more even.
That's insane. Look, how much does an MRI cost you?
You mean how much does it cost for me to give someone an MRI?
Right. This silly scene is actually a true story in healthcare. An MRI at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City will have one price, but the price is probably going to be different than an MRI down the street at Weill Cornell or at the Cleveland Clinic or the Mayo Clinic or UCLA Medical Center. The president wants healthcare costs for consumers to come down, but Dr. Vivian Lee says that's impossible unless doctors understand their own costs. And she says they don't. And she's the CEO at University of Utah Healthcare, where they give a lot of MRIs.
It's funny you mention MRI because I am a radiologist, so I've spent a lot of time around MRI machines. One of the questions that our team asked was, what does it cost for every minute in the MRI scanner, every minute in the OR, every minute in the ER? Because once you fully appreciate the cost, then you can really start to question, well, how much time do we need to be spending in that scanner to make a good diagnosis and to be able to help the patient? And so, yes, to answer your question, we did calculate what it costs for every minute in each of those settings.
Now, knowing the cost, though, doesn't mean that you have to give up this negotiation process, because it depends on whether you're dealing with Medicare or which insurance provider, or if you're dealing actually with an indigent. The amount of revenue coming from each one of your customers can differ radically, right? So that doesn't change here so much.
You know, that's a great question, John. And one of the real drivers right now is what we call payment reform, or changes in the ways in which we are paid for delivering health care. And I think that at the core of it, these changes in payments, which Secretary Burwell is really driving out of HHS, which will really impact Medicare and Medicaid. And similarly, many of the large health insurance companies are also driving, is actually really critical to our future, I think, in this country, because what they're trying to drive is, rather than having each particular component negotiated and then the price negotiated for each part, whether it's an MRI or a CAT scan or a drug that you might have to take. Instead, what they're saying is, you know, let's pay providers for delivering great outcomes for patients. So if a patient comes in for a total hip replacement, if they have a great outcome, let's just pay providers a fixed lump sum for taking care of the patient and let them manage all the details of it. And in order to do something like that successfully as a healthcare system, we need to be able to internally measure the costs, measure the quality, measure the outcomes for each of those patients. So I think in order to help fix our healthcare system, we need to think about connecting more rationally the way in which we get paid to the kind of outcomes that our patients want. And for us to succeed in that environment, we need to have tools like our value-driven outcomes tool at the University of Utah.
Are patients better partners in keeping costs down if they know the cost of the services that they're getting, whether they're even paying for it or not?
We really believe in transparency. I think that patients, when they're engaged in their healthcare and when they understand what is happening, that's a better outcome for everyone. Not just patients, but their families too. It's a team effort. At the University of Utah, about maybe 2.5, 3 years ago, we actually undertook one of the first steps in transparency and really gauging patients when we decided to post all of our patient satisfaction scores and comments from all of our patients that we receive on all the surveys that we get from them online. And we did this at the end of 2012. I think we were the first in the country, if I'm not mistaken. And it was a real success in terms of the way in which our patients felt about being able to have more insight. I mean, if you think about it, you wouldn't buy a toaster oven without looking for those five stars on Amazon, or booking a hotel without looking at TripAdvisor, for example. Why should you have to pick a physician without knowing a little bit about what other patients thought about them?
Dr. Vivian Lee is the CEO of the University of Utah Healthcare Center. Dr. Lee, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Lawyers are preparing for several days of contempt hearings against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio that'll begin later this month. The case has grown to the point that there are as many as a dozen different interests and even more law firms than that involved. And as KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports, Maricopa County taxpayers are footing a lot of the legal bills.
Sheriff Joe Arpaio is facing contempt of court for violating a judge's orders in a racial profiling case. The ongoing contempt case has taken surprising turns. Revelations of the sheriff's secret investigations, attempts to remove the judge from the case, and even allegations of stolen CIA files. So the courtroom meetings draw a few regular spectators. One is Andy Jacob, a local attorney.
I mean, this is entertaining, and it's sad that it's entertaining. They could make a film about this.
Jacob isn't directly involved in this case, but one of the things that makes this case so unusual is how many attorneys are.
The attorneys that are there don't even fit on the judge's side of the bar. They have to sit in the audience because there's not enough room. There's just so many people.
By KJZZ's count, about 17 law firms and legal groups, plus two different divisions of the U.S. Department of Justice, are involved. Some of these lawyers represent the sheriff and other staff facing contempt of court, but it doesn't end there. Maricopa County has its own lawyers. So do Arpaio's former attorneys who've withdrawn from the case, as does the Maricopa County attorney. Yes, this case has gotten so big, even the lawyers have lawyers.
I'll sit there sometimes and I think, what is the sum total of fees per hour that are generated in this case and who's paying for it?
Maricopa County taxpayers have already forked over $8 million in legal bills since the original racial profiling case began 8 years ago. That included the plaintiff's lawyer's fees since they won. Now in this contempt phase, taxpayers are paying for at least eight private law firms to represent county employees and county interests. KJZZ requested billing records from the county to find out just how much that costs. Estimates from the records provided show that every time the parties come to court, it costs taxpayers close to $2,000 an hour in legal bills.
Nobody involved in this case ever envisioned that it would get this big.
Terry Woods is one of the private lawyers hired by the county. I caught up with him outside of court. He joined the case in May.
And since then, I've read 6 million pieces of paper trying to catch up with this enormous monster.
His clients are two Maricopa County deputy county attorneys. They used to be on the sheriff's legal team, but withdrew in April. They're now being deposed.
It's certainly unfortunate that taxpayers, to protect a couple of its employees, has to pay me. But these people's professional future and their reputation's at stake. They're entitled to counsel, and that they shouldn't be paying for it out of their own pocket.
Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery says he's been forced to appoint more and more private attorneys in this case. He says it's because of a federal appeals court ruling in April that said Maricopa County should be a named defendant in the original racial profiling case. It's a ruling Montgomery is fighting.
Once the county was named as a party, I then, as the county attorney, can't represent all sides of the defense.
Because the county and the sheriff may not agree. So Montgomery pulled off the deputy county attorneys who once represented the sheriff and appointed private counsel in their place. And he hired separate private attorneys to represent the county. They've already billed more than $200,000 since April.
It's costing a lot, yes.
But Montgomery says he has to make sure everyone's fairly represented, and he hopes this will all be over soon.
Everybody wants the sheriff's office, including the sheriff and his command team, to be found in compliance so that we can end the additional expenses that are being incurred.
But there are still many legal bills ahead. Attorneys are working around the clock this month in long depositions and long hours of document review. And then they'll be back in court for several full days of contempt hearings that are slated to begin September 23rd. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. The day after tomorrow will be 3 days before Tuesday. What day is today? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. Still to come, a Phoenix nonprofit trains teens to help their peers with their problems. And it's not just the hotline callers who seem to benefit.
For a lot of our volunteers, it's the first time that they've ever felt like they could make a difference in the world, as well as it's the first time that they may have actually had really healthy relationships with other people and even other adults.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, I-10 eastbound, an accident at Central. It'll be partly sunny for the rest of the day today. Slight chance for some showers and storms this afternoon. Look for a high of 96 degrees. 100 is average for today. Clear skies tonight. Still a slight chance of storms. Overnight lows near 80. It has gotten a little more cloudy over the course of the hour so far. Right now it's 94 degrees at 2:34.
KJZZ is supported by Polsinelli, a national full-service law firm focused on understanding client challenges and providing legal guidance grounded in business acumen. Polsinelli.com. Real challenges, real answers.
But first, this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Hungary's border with Serbia is closed, sealed off today with huge coils of barbed wire, underlining the Hungarian government's determination to block the influx of migrants trying to use that country as a gateway to Western Europe. Hungary has declared a state of emergency. President Obama is calling on the international community to join the U.S. in taking in refugees fleeing the civil war in Syria. He spoke after meeting with Spain's King Felipe at the White House.
We agreed that this is going to require cooperation with all the European countries and the United States and the international community in order to ensure that people are safe, that they are treated with shared humanity.
Obama told the king he hopes to visit Spain before his term as president ends. Teachers in Seattle are looking over a tentative contract announced by negotiators this morning. If approved, that deal would end a 5-day strike. Kyle Stokes of member station KPLU reports the walkout has delayed the start of school for the city's 53,000 students.
At least for today, teachers will remain on the picket lines. The district hopes students will be back in school by Thursday. Negotiators for the district and the teachers union worked through the night. They finally reached a tentative agreement this morning. Jeff Miller led the district's bargaining team.
The parties were far apart for a long time, but in the end, we found common ground, wanting to make sure that our children get the best education that they can.
Terms of the deal will remain private until union members get a chance to review them. The union's governing board and representative assembly still have to give their okay before the full membership can vote on it. For NPR News, I'm Kyle Stokes in Seattle.
Hewlett-Packard says it will cut between 25 and 30,000 additional jobs after its enterprise division splits from the company's printer and PC division. This is NPR News.
In a check of the news from KJZZ in Phoenix, emergency responders are still searching for five people who were swept into a flash flood Monday in Hilldale, Utah. That's near the Arizona border. An additional nine people are confirmed dead. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Community member Ted Barlow posted a YouTube video of the muddy waters raging through his front yard. In the video, you can hear children screaming and Barlow warning one to stand back. Emergency responders rescued three people. One was hospitalized. Michelle Chatwin is a spokeswoman for Washington County Emergency Services.
There were several vehicles that were swept down into the flood. Two of the vehicles were occupied. There were 16 people between the two vehicles.
More footage of the flood showed women rescued from vehicles wearing the long prairie dresses characteristic of the polygamous community. Hilldale, Utah, and its sister town, Colorado City, Arizona, are home to the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
The world is running out of one of the most effective treatments for snake bites. That, at least, is a warning being sounded by the medical charity Doctors Without Borders. The charity says the final batch of a treatment will expire next year after the manufacturer said it was no longer commercially viable. The BBC's Tulip Mazumda has been to the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine in northwest England, where scientists are trying to develop new antivenins.
So we're outside Snake Room 4 in our herpetarium at the Alistair Reid Venom Research Unit in Liverpool. And in this room we have most of our big-bodied, dangerous venomous snakes.
Dr. Nick Casewell is introducing me to some of the world's deadliest snakes.
Make sure that you've got your protective glasses on. We've got spitting cobras in the facility, so we just want to make sure that everything's as safe as possible.
Okay. There's row after row of exotic snakes in glass cases and plastic boxes, watching our every move as we enter.
So, small viper. This group of snakes kill more people in the world than any other group of snakes.
It's so small, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's what? How big is that?
Probably about 40 centimetres long. So the main problem with this snake is that it just lives in the fields where the farming communities, particularly in West Africa, are there every single day. And they're really well camouflaged, and they also live under stones. So as soon as these farmers move the stones, they don't see the snake and they step on it and they get bitten. And most of these people, they don't have protective footwear, so they're just wearing flip-flops or they're barefoot. The result of people who are bitten by this snake is that they bleed, and they often bleed to death. So there's probably about 7,000 or 8,000 people dying every single year as a result of bites by this tiny little snake.
Ooh, look at him. Gosh, he's bashing inside his box, isn't he? Gosh! Oh my gosh! God, they move fast, don't they?
Yeah, that they're incredible. In fact, this snake notorious for how quickly they strike.
Oh,
and
my
goodness! Obviously, you'd have no chance to react. We should probably leave this one alone.
I think we should back
stop
off.
Stop upsetting it.
All right, are you ready? Ready? Yeah. You got the hook? I might need help with this because it's so big.
From a safe distance, I watch a crucial part of the process of developing new antivenoms. Snakes are carefully taken out of their boxes. They're then encouraged to bite into a container.
Here we go.
Releasing the venom.
Brilliant. That's a ton of venom there.
Tiny amounts are then given to horses or sheep, which create antibodies to fight the poison, and that is used in antivenom. It's an expensive process. Stocks of what experts call the most effective antivenom in sub-Saharan Africa, Fav-Afrique, will expire in June, and there's no more coming. Dr. Rob Harrison heads up the research unit here.
It's a neglected problem. People just don't understand that 100,000 people are dying from snake bite every year. So maybe 500,000 people are suffering severe disfigurement as a result of snake bite.
The medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières is calling for pharmaceuticals and governments to do more to develop new antivenoms. Polly Mercandia speaks for the charity.
You know, most of the people who are bitten by snakes are poor and they live in rural areas. And so they don't constitute a very profitable market. So although there are other products coming on stream, the quality is not as high.
Experts from around the world are meeting in Switzerland to try and find a solution to help deal with the devastation caused by these killer creatures.
That's the BBC's global health correspondent, Tulip Mazumda. There's a new place to get connected to local food. GoodFoodFinderAZ.com is a product of Local First Arizona and aims to link Arizonans to food grown and produced nearby. Kimber Lanning is founder and director of Local First Arizona.
We're really trying to better connect people to healthy local foods near them. So in addition to farms and ranches, you can find farmers markets, community gardens, and soon you're going to be able to find restaurants, retailers, cooperatives, anything related to local food systems.
Was this information not available in one spot before?
It was not. So what we were hearing was a lot of people moving into the area from other regions where they may have been completely connected to a farmer's market or even a CSA where they have a food box delivered to their door with fresh in-season vegetables. And they would move here and they would think, well, where can I go and where do I find this information? And this is a statewide directory. We're going to tell you where you can tap into local foods no matter where you are.
What's the benefit to Arizona residents of having this?
Well, the first thing is local food is healthier. It's traveled less distance, so it's been sprayed with less chemicals, generally speaking. It also keeps more money recirculating in the local economy. A lot of our local chefs really love local foods because they're using fresh ingredients that were often just picked that day or the day before. So you're really getting the robust flavors of the foods, and you're also going to be getting more over what's fresh and in season, which is really important to the environment. And secondarily, they're very aware of the economic benefits as well. As much as 80 to 90 cents for every dollar spent goes directly back to the producers themselves. And that's really a boon for Arizona's economy as well.
Are there other states or even municipalities that have done something like this? Have you modeled this on something that you saw elsewhere?
We really didn't. We did get the idea, however, from Colorado, and the Colorado Department of Agriculture does an excellent job of listing really comprehensively what's going on in agriculture across that state, and it manifests itself in a campaign called Colorado Proud, so that people can, with using a little sticker, kind of like our Arizona Grown, can use a little sticker that identifies what was grown here or what was grown there in the Colorado Proud case. But there was no comprehensive website. And, you know, an additional point that I want to bring up is we're going to be showing where populations can use WIC and SNAP benefits to access healthy local food. So, you know, it's the first time ever, you know, the government said, well, farmers markets are now going to accept what is essentially food stamps. We call them WIC and SNAP benefits. But there was no marketing budget to tell anyone about that. So we're really coming in here and trying to build a plan that allows people to really tap into the healthy local food that's nearest them.
Kimber Lanning is founder and director of Local First Arizona. Kimber, thanks as always.
Mark, thank you.
With the return of school this fall, the stress level for kids escalates. The pressures of classwork, the demands of homework, and maybe a part-time job, the new and ever-evolving dynamics of peer groups, it can all create a lot of tension and anxiety. September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and one Phoenix-based nonprofit trains teenagers to help their peers. Teen Lifeline has been around since 1986, taking calls from teens who need help. For more on the group, I spoke to 17-year-old Anna, who's been volunteering there for about a year and a half. Anna, by the way, is not her real name, but the one she uses on the hotline. I also spoke with Nikki Kuntz, Teen Lifeline's clinical director. I asked Nikki what exactly the service is about.
What we know is that teens like to talk to other teens, usually their friends, when they have problems before they go to their parents or other adults. And so that's where Teen Lifeline was born, and that we're a place where teens can call and they get to talk to someone their own age about any kind of problem, big or little. So we deal with everything from I had a rough day at school, got a fight with my best friend, all the way to things like kids thinking about giving up and maybe thinking about suicide.
What kind of training do the teen counselors get? Because I just think back to when I was a teenager, I don't think anybody should have been taking the advice that I would have been giving at that time. So how do you make sure that the folks like Anna who are answering the phone are telling their peers basically to do the right thing?
Well, I think actually that's an important distinction. We actually don't give advice on the hotline. We train the volunteers, and they go through really extensive training. It's a 72-hour base training, and they learn everything from basic communication skills, how to talk about feelings, how to talk about and identify their own feelings. And really, they are also trained at learning about what to ask when you're worried about someone dealing with any kind of issue. And they are always supervised by master's level clinicians. The one thing we can say about the training is that it's a life skills training. Really, what we train them to do is to help the callers identify what it is in their life they want to have change, and what are things, strengths, and things and people of support in their life that can help make that better for them. And then they build an action plan with the caller.
Anna, is it difficult to answer the phone as often as you do and just hear problem upon problem upon problem and dealing with all these issues that people your own age are having?
Nikki said before, we go through a lot of training beforehand, so I think that we're really prepared to kind of take in all the problems that people are going through, and we can process them through ourselves, but we also have peers with us that we can have conversations with afterwards if we're having trouble just dealing with it, dealing with hearing all those things that other people are going through. But at the end of a call, when the caller has their action plan and they know what they're going to do and they're feeling really confident, it makes you feel a lot better in their situation, and I think you can end a call feeling even better than at the beginning.
Have you found that the skills you learned during the training and even maybe some of what you've heard during the calls has helped you in your life?
I think that it definitely has. It's opened my eyes kind of in a new perspective to see the world where I feel really lucky in my life that I don't have as many problems as other people do, and I feel like I've become more aware of just how hard it really is to be a teenager in other people's lives.
Anna, have you ever come upon a phone call where you just didn't know what to say to somebody?
I feel like I definitely have. And there are many like slip-ups that you have and awkward silences. But
as with any teenage conversation,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course. but we do have a supervisor that is always there to help us if we get stuck on something and we don't know what to say. We also are trained to have different open questions that we can use that helps us dig deeper in the situation if we don't know what else to ask.
I hate to be glib about this, but is this in some way sort of an outdated technology? I mean, you think about how teenagers communicate. They
right.
text, they Facebook, they tweet. Picking up a phone and dialing a number is not usually the first mode of communication that you think of.
Mm-hmm. That's something that, you know, we continuously watch. We are looking at expanding our technology. But what I can tell you is that our calls continue to increase year after year. And when you think about some of the other technologies that exist, especially for text messaging for teens specifically, when they're talking about their problems, that's a lot of information to get in a text. And so while teens might initiate conversations that way, that's not usually where they end up really having the deeper conversations.
Anna, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I guess from my personal experience, I know that it is easier to talk about deep conversations and stuff like that over text if you're going to talk about just like a small thing. But I think if I were feeling just really bad and stuff like that, I would call because I guess I would just be really desperate and need someone to talk to. And I feel like any caller would want to talk about their problems over the phone because they could feel the other person's presence. I think it makes it more natural, more face-to-face kind of conversation.
How many teen volunteers do you have?
Right now, I have around, I think, about 89.
The people who come in to do this, do they tend to stay for a little while? Like, what's the turnover like?
Our average length of stay for the volunteers on the hotline is about 3 years.
That seems like a long time, especially for the what else is going on in kids'
right.
lives at that time.
You know, what's amazing is that we have these teen volunteers coming in and volunteering their time to talk to these other kids on the hotline and these other teens that really need help. But what we also work towards is to actually create that same environment for them. So we recognize that there's really not much difference between our volunteers and our callers. They're going through the same stuff. We just make sure that Teen Lifeline continues to be a place where they can
also get that same support. And for a lot of our volunteers, it's the first time that they've ever felt like they could make a difference in the world, as well as it's the first time that they may have actually had really healthy relationships with other people and even other adults.
Nikki Koontz is clinical director for Teen Lifeline. We also heard from 17-year-old volunteer Anna, which is her hotline name, not her real one. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Look for partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with about a 10% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Look for a high of 96. 100 is average for today. Clear skies tonight, still a slight chance of showers and storms. Overnight lows near 80. Partly to mostly sunny skies tomorrow and right on through the rest of the work week with a high of 95 tomorrow. It's 94 degrees at 252.
KJZZ is supported by the Salvation Army, serving nearly 30 million Americans each year for 150 years, including thousands in Arizona since 1892. SalvationArmyPhoenix.org, doing the most good.
iPads are now in the hands of hundreds of K-12 students in Arizona schools as they attempt to integrate new technologies and prepare students for future careers. But that educational process is being hindered in some districts because schools struggle to provide high-speed internet access. From the KJZZ Science Desk, Stephanie Sanchez reports many schools need thousands of dollars in funding so they can upgrade their school network infrastructures.
Seven-year-old Mateo Eras shows us his favorite game on his brand new iPad. Mateo is learning how to build roller coasters on an app that exposes him to the world of physics and engineering. It's one of the many educational games Mateo downloaded at school. This second grader is among the thousands of students and teachers in the Crane Elementary School District who will be downloading, uploading, emailing, working, or playing online after the introduction of iPads.
I felt happy because, we usually don't have iPads at home and at school.
But hundreds of kids using iPads in the classroom are a challenge for schools without a modern internet infrastructure. Access can be slower and bottleneck the system. That's why Trina Siegfried, grant writer for Crane Elementary School District, has been filling out a lot of grant applications to improve access.
AT&T invited us to write a grant also for cellular data service on the iPads. So we are waiting to get final word whether we've been awarded that or not. But Apple was gracious enough to provide us with cellular-enabled devices for all of our students so that if we are awarded the grant through AT&T, our students would have access to the internet to send homework back and forth to their teacher, to reach out via email, as well as collaborating with one another on projects.
iPads enabled with cellular data service work a lot like a cell phone. With the help of a grant, students will be able to work online at home if needed. Other school districts in Yuma County are also working on amping up their on-site networks. Yuma Union High School District and Yuma Elementary School District 1 recently signed a long-term lease agreement with WANRAC. WANRAC provides high-speed private fiber optic networks to schools nationwide. They'll work in Yuma to connect 25 sites across the two school districts. The upgrade will connect nearly 20,000 students and staff. WANRAC networks provide unlimited bandwidth without the bottlenecks or the security and reliability concerns that plague users of shared public networks. Dean Farrar, Director of Technology for the Yuma Educational Technology Consortium.
It's a great opportunity for not just for our schools. Going down this road will be advantageous for our entire community. It adds another service provider into the community.
But once the school day is over, some students face another obstacle.
Do you have internet at home?
No.
No?
They're going to get internet because my mom has an iPad. So we could get internet, my mom could use a Safari.
But some of Mateo's fellow students may not be so lucky. Some families simply can't afford internet access at home. To help close the digital divide, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey announced a partnership with Cox Communication. The new program could help Arizona families qualify for low-cost internet services. Governor Ducey says less than half of students in low-income homes have internet access versus more than 90% in high-income families. Other providers are also exploring ways to bring internet to low-income areas.
That's Stephanie Sanchez reporting for the Arizona Science Desk. It's September. You've made it through the worst part of the Phoenix summer, so, you know, congratulations. Sometimes those days of 100-plus high temps can feel like a test of endurance, but that's exactly why so many manufacturers choose Phoenix to test their materials. Plastic, paint, vinyl. The show's Annika Klein went to a test site to see how those materials fare in the Valley of the Sun.
You think 117 degrees was hot? Try twice that temperature.
It's way hotter than anything living should be subjected to.
That's Chad Olson, a testing supervisor with Q-Lab Test Services. He shows me around their test site on a dirt field in Buckeye. Nothing living growing out here, just rows of metal panels that tilt on an axis to follow the sun. And boxes containing vehicle parts. Olson explains the glass tops on the boxes mimic a car windshield.
We have the box, and obviously this is a dashboard.
And while we stand outside in a comfortable 90 degrees, that dashboard is feeling the heat. Olson says the temperature in there can get up to 230 degrees.
When you're in this closed environment, the heat just builds and builds. You can get well over the boiling point in there, and it'll just stay there all day.
It's what happens to Phoenix cars in parking lots as their drivers go shopping or to work. If you can't find a shady spot, the UV rays are hitting your dash at full blast. Michael Crudson is managing director for Q-Lab, and says UV rays are as tough on plastics as they are on your skin, except that people can regrow damaged cells. A car can't.
So it's getting a sunburn every day and not recovering.
This dashboard still looks pretty normal. There isn't much that changes in just a matter of a few months. But further back in the field, Q-Lab has some old-timers.
Over in this area, we've got some more of the more plastic specimens.
Rectangles of vinyl siding, the type you might find on a house, that have been out here for the past 15 years. And some of them are looking worse for wear. Crudson points out a trio of blackened rectangles.
Those were really nice, dark, rich, reddy brown color when they were first exposed.
The downside to this type of test, though, is that it takes a long time. So Q-Lab also offers accelerated tests that use a series of mirrors to reflect about 10 times the amount of UV rays back onto the materials, like a super intense tanning booth. Crudson explains that this setup requires two large fans.
And it keeps them from getting too hot and bursting into flame.
Because 10 times the UV rays also equals 10 times the temperature. Just like Phoenicians learn to adapt to summers here, manufacturing companies learn to adapt their products. For example, Olson says some car companies are developing infrared-resistant paints.
They actually reflect the infrared back out, so a black car with this new paint might be almost as cool as a white car from, you know, the previous models.
As for us, I guess we'll just have to break out the SPF 50 like we do every year. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
I'm joined now by Steve Goldstein, host, among other things, of KJZZ's Here and Now. Hey, Steve.
Mark, is that my new theme song?
Do you want it to be?
I love it.
I think we could arrange that. Tomorrow morning at 11, KJZZ's Here and Now. What do you got?
Well, with all the renewed discussion about immigration reform, we'll be focused on sort of the less emotional aspect of it. Farm workers, trends that are happening there from a national and Arizona perspective. And also, we'll meet an artist who made a couple of video installations related to immigration, both from Guatemala and Mexico. Really pretty fascinating stuff. One scene, he's in a Home Depot in Los Angeles, and people are just going about their business as all this activity is going on. Pretty interesting.
Interesting stuff as always. That's KJZZ's Here and Now, tomorrow morning at 11. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Mark.
The show is produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer, our news director, Al Macias, executive producer, John Hoban. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Good story ideas, the show at kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Rescuers on the Utah-Arizona border have discovered additional bodies in the mud and rubble left by a flash flood yesterday. NPR's Howard Berkus reports the death toll has now risen to 12, with one person still listed as missing.
The threat of more flash flooding forced a cautious rescue effort early Tuesday, but the Weather Service lifted its flood warning at noon local time. Search dogs and about 600 volunteers are looking for the missing. Heavy equipment is clearing tons of mud and debris. Flash floods are common in the border towns of Hilldale, Utah, and Colorado City, Arizona, which sit at the base of a skyscraping sandstone mountain. But old-timers say they've never seen a flood like this. Most of the victims are children who were in two vehicles overtaken